I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Tavis Smiley says that he was helped by the speeches of Martin Luther King Jr. during a difficult period of his childhood. Smiley's book, Death of a King, is about a difficult period in King's life from April 1967 to April 1968 when he was murdered. King criticized the Vietnam War and was vilified by the press, by leaders of the civil rights movement, and much of the public. He also spoke out about the connection between war and racism and poverty. Tavis Smiley says King's tragic death made him a martyr that paradoxically has ended up sanitizing his message. Tavis Smiley is the host of the Tavis Smiley Show on PBS, also the Tavis Smiley Show on Public Radio International, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, good to see you. Glad to be back. Thanks for the invitation.
You're very welcome. Why did you want to focus on the last year of King's life? And there's some very interesting bookends.
Mm-hmm. It's the story that hasn't been told. King gives the I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington, of course, Marty, in 1963. He's dead in 68, as you just referenced. And we don't know the story of the last year of his life. And why is it important to know? Because whether you're talking Marty or Tavis or anybody listening right now, I think we agree on this. We come to know who we really are as human beings in the dark and difficult days of our lives. So if you don't know the dark and difficult days of Martin's life, which happened to be the last year, then you really don't know him yet.
Well, what's so fascinating, and I was alive at the time, although not a particularly thinking person at the time, You quote a Harris poll, something like 75% of the public had basically written him off.
Three quarters of the American people in that last poll thought he was irrelevant, but what the real tragedy is that almost 60% of black people thought he was persona non grata. And you tell people that today, given how we have sort of deified him in death, they have a hard time juxtaposing the deification in death with the demonization in life. It's a interesting polar.
But do you think it's because of the speech he gave at Riverside Church about the Vietnam War?
No doubt about it. April 4, 1967, he gives the most controversial speech of his life. He's dead 1 year to the day later, April 4, 1968. But in that speech, when he calls the U.S. the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, that was a strong and damning indictment of our government's policy. And Johnson, who he had worked with, President Johnson, who he'd worked with to get the Voting Rights Act passed and the Civil Rights Act passed, saw Martin turn on him as he perceived it. And Martin thought that that Johnson, who had announced a war on poverty, was now engaged on a war in Vietnam. And so the resources, King put it this way, war is the enemy of the poor. The bombs you're dropping there are landing in the ghettos and barrios of U.S. cities.
Was there something, though, about that particular war, even a time at this war, 1967, that turned King against it? Had he been sort of neutral on it?
He had been working his way up to come out as forcefully as he did in that speech called Beyond Vietnam, which you can find online. I think it's one of the great speeches he's ever given. But again, people don't want to, they want to do with I Have a Dream, not Beyond Vietnam.
Right.
But he'd been talking about the war. He was opposed to the war. He was on record as being opposed to it, but he knew that, as he said in the speech that night, there comes a time where silence is betrayal. And he knew that he had to speak up. He said, my conscience tonight leaves me no other choice. So he knew that there was going to be hell to pay for giving the speech. He just did not know, Marty, how bad it was going to be literally the very next day when every major paper in the country turned on him.
In fact, you include some headlines and some quotes from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and they really went after him.
And I chose those publications because I wanted the reader to understand that the so-called liberal press went after him. So you can imagine what the other folk were saying. But the New York Times, the Washington Post, Time Magazine, almost 50 years after his death, it is embarrassing, it's humiliating, it's painful to read what the Times and the Post said about him the day after.
What did they say?
He was irrelevant, that he had done a disservice to his people, that he was no longer of any use, that he had miscalculated. I mean, it got ugly. Time Magazine said it sounded like they didn't say infomercial, but the point was Time Magazine suggested that he had done basically an infomercial for Hanoi Radio. I mean, it was damning what they said about him the day after. And it just got worse from April 4, 67 until he took that bullet April 4, 68.
Are you surprised how many black leaders turned against King? And was it because of the war and perhaps because of what Lyndon Johnson had done for African Americans in this country?
The latter, more so than the former. Johnson had been the best friend that the Negro had in America, so these leaders thought, since Lincoln had freed the slaves. Johnson had passed, as I said earlier, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. So they saw Martin sort of betraying the president, biting the hand that was feeding them, and they were like, Negro, you're going to mess it up for all of us by going after the president in this way. So it's just stunning. I mean, black audiences find this remarkable. And I've seen people's mouths just drop open on book tour when they learn that Roy Wilkins and the NAACP came out against him publicly. Whitney Young and the Urban League came out against him publicly. Adam Clayton Powell Jr. was hating on him publicly. Ralph Bunche, the only other black Nobel laureate, turned on him publicly. And I can't even quote on radio what Thurgood Marshall said about it.
Well, I'm going to quote him, and I'll just leave out one of the words here.
This
is Thurgood Marshall talking about Martin Luther King Jr., describing as a boy on a man's errand. This is the civil rights movement and civil disobedience. He says, as an organizer, he wasn't worth he was a great speaker, but as for getting the work done, he was not good at that. All he did was dump all his legal bills on us. That would be the NAACP, including the bills. And that was all right with him, so long as he didn't have to pay the bills. Ouch.
Exactly.
Is that true? I mean, did he dump the bills on the NAACP?
The bourgeois elite Negroes, like Thurgood Marshall, never really fancied Martin in the first place, because Martin came from a well-to-do, you know, middle-class family in Atlanta, nice neighborhood, two-parent family, all of that. And so they couldn't ever understand why he wanted to put on overalls and march with the poor and go to jail. And they didn't quite understand. He had a PhD. Basically, they were saying, Negro, behave yourself. You're one of us. Why are you acting this way? And they didn't, again, like him, making it, as they saw, tough on the rest of them by angering the president who had been so good to them. So they essentially became surrogates for the Johnson White House, yeah, attacking Martin King publicly. But when you tell audiences, again, that the NAACP and the Urban League and black leaders turned on him, black media turned on him, people have a hard time juxtaposing that with the way we, honor him today.
How did he deal with that? I mean, is there any way to know? I mean, how he dealt with it publicly, but he also had to deal with it privately.
It was tough, Marty. It was tough. He was depressed. He was despondent from time to time. He had been admitted to the hospital a number of times over the last couple of years, and the official reason always was for exhaustion. As a matter of fact, there's a great story in the book, as you know, about his being in Philadelphia one day and falling ill, and a wonderful story about a Philadelphia physician, a black physician, who nursed him back to health when he was sick here in Philadelphia. So that, he had a hard time navigating his way through it, but he prayed his way through. He sung his way through. There are stories in the book. You'll see him singing and praying and certainly preaching. What struck me was the last year, the sermons that he preached every Sunday back. He was on the road all the time, but he always got back to Atlanta for Sunday service at Ebenezer, the church he pastored with his father, co-pastored with his father, Daddy King. And to read and to listen to those sermons over the last year, you can hear him pulling and praying and, quite frankly, sometimes even confessing his way through that last year.
Well, speaking of confessing, one of the things he did do at one point in his life was to confess to Coretta, his wife, that he had been having affairs. And this was a man on the road a lot.
Yeah. Coretta had a surgery, and at one point in the last year of his life, Coretta had a surgery, and Martin thought that he might lose Coretta. And he realized, he always loved her, of course, and had a wonderful family. But he realized, I think, in that moment, what his life might have been like had he lost Coretta. And he purposed in his heart that he was going to tell her the truth about, some of the mistakes he'd made in his life. And so while she was recuperating, he told her. Her friends didn't like that. Their attitude was like, why at a moment like this would you say this? But his perspective was that he had to get that off his chest, because Coretta had survived. Thank God she was still living, and he wanted to deal with that. And so he did it. But again, that was another act of, some would take exception to this when I say an act of courage, because he, was having, some affairs. But he wanted to get that out of him. He knew that there was a bullet out there with his name on it. And if I say confessions, in his sermons, in his personal life, he was trying to, exercise those demons, as it were.
How did Coretta feel about that? I mean, it's one thing to be the teller. It's another thing to be the recipient of that information.
Yeah, in the text, we don't get into how she felt about it per se. There's a line or two about it, because this book is unique, as you know, from any other book written about Dr. King, because the obvious question is, why another book about Dr. King? Well, one, the story of what happens to him in the last year, as I said earlier, hasn't been told as yet. We're stuck on I Have a Dream in 63. But the other thing about this book is that it's told, as you know, from his perspective. So this is a book where I put you in his inner circle. You're in the space with him. As a matter of fact, in the book, he's never referred to as Dr. King. He's Doc.
I know. I wanted to ask you about that, because I have to say, when I first opened it and started reading, and there's a reason you call him Doc, and I just felt like, How presumptuous, Tavis Smiley, to be calling Martin Luther King
Which is
Doc.
Which is why I addressed that in the introduction. I wanted to say to the reader, you're going to know him as Doc because I want to humanize him. I want to take him off the pedestal and humanize him. So if I'm going to write a book from his perspective, that is to say, here's what he was seeing, what he was going through every day for the last year of his life. I want you to experience that. I want you to feel it. I want you to be there with him in these moments with him, the good, the bad, the ugly, the ups, the downs, the depression. He's crying. He's praying. He can't understand it. He's being abandoned. I want you to feel what the exhaustion, traveling all the time. But everybody in his inner circle called him Doc. And so yeah. If I'm going to put you in that space, I want you to have a relationship with him. And so he's Doc to you. He's Doc to me. He's Doc to everybody.
And do you think of him as sort of alone in this last year of his life?
Beautiful.
I mean, clearly abandoned by so many people, but...
Beautiful question.
But also surrounded by a lot of people as well.
Beautiful question, Marty, as your questions tend to be. That's exactly what it was. I said that earlier today, that he died alone. When you look at, you know, the pictures of him, you know, lying on that balcony with blood everywhere, there are people in the photo. But Martin essentially died alone because everybody's turned on him. The media, the White House, white folk, black folk, in his own organization, as you know from the text. He couldn't get his own organization, SCLC, to support him on his Poor People's Campaign that he was trying to organize. His own organization, I mean, this is mind-boggling. His own organization initially passed this is his group, SCLC. They passed a resolution condemning him, basically, for speaking out against the war. It's his own, these are his people who are passing a resolution, his board of directors, to spank him on the wrist for talking about the war, for coming out so forcefully against the war in Vietnam.
But on the other side, you've got the Black Panther movement. You've mm-hmm. got the rise of the Black Power movement, mm-hmm. who I'm sure saw King as perhaps too vanilla for them.
And so what happens is, to your point, that he's out of step with one group of Negroes, out of touch with another group. For the bourgeois elite Negroes, as we've already established, he's out of step because they don't want him getting into it with Lyndon Johnson, making their lives difficult. Martin, this is not our issue. This is a foreign policy matter. Let's stay focused on civil rights or whatever. So the bourgeois elite are upset with him. But the everyday black folk, and certainly the young folk, to your point, are into black power. They want to hear not Martin King. Keep in mind now, Martin's only 38 at this point.
Yeah,
he's still a young guy. Yeah, but they want to hear Stokely Carmichael. They want to hear H. Rapp Brown. They want to hear Huey Newton. So he's out of step with one group of black folk, out of touch with another group. He doesn't even have a constituency amongst his own people.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. If that voice sounds familiar, it's because it's Tavis Smiley. He has a TV show on PBS. It's a talk show, The Tavis Smiley Show. Also has a show on Public Radio International, The Tavis Smiley Show. And he is our guest on Radio Times. He's written a book with David Ritz called Death of a King, and it's subtitled The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. And truly bookended between a speech he gave in April of 1967, the Riverside speech, where he speaks against the war in Vietnam, and exactly 1 year later, his assassination in Memphis, Tennessee. We're going to take a very short break, then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call to join the conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in Project Impact, a research study at Drexel University. This weight loss program is designed to help adult men and women lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. Project Impact is funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-553-7110. Drexel University supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Director Terry Gilliam's fantastical new film, The Zero Theorem, centers around a notoriously unsolvable math equation.
Management's been handpicking talent to crunch it since before I was hired. Nobody lasts. It's a guaranteed burnout project. I worked on it for about 3 weeks when I was a young hotshot, fresh out of school, drove me balmy.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The American Philosophical Society Museum invites visitors to remember where it all began, to view Jefferson's handwritten draft of the Declaration of Independence, and to discover what the city of brotherly love was really like during the Revolutionary War. Jefferson's Guide to Philadelphia provides a view of your city and its history through new eyes. Jefferson, Philadelphia, and the Founding of a Nation, now through December. To learn more, APSmuseum.org. The APS Museum supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Tavis Smiley about his new book called Death of a King. It's about the last year of King's life. And Tavis Smiley says, yes, many books have been written about King and articles as well, but he wanted to focus on the last literally 365 days of King's life and talk about the king that was vilified by many, who was a very unpopular figure in this country. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. King also, during this period, makes this connection between militarism, perhaps the war in Vietnam, racism, and poverty, and connects the three. What was his message then?
He called it the triple threat of racism, militarism, and poverty. And his point simply was then that our democracy is threatened if we don't start to address these three issues. And how right was he then? How right is he now? You fast forward almost 50 years later to Ferguson, Missouri. What did you see on display in Ferguson? Racism, poverty, and militarism. So if he were here today, he'd have some critiques of the American empire, critiques of the Obama presidency on that triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism.
Was that also a message that sort of took him off his pedestal at the time? I mean, was that considered a controversial message?
Absolutely. I mean, as long as Martin was in the civil rights lane, he was okay. And what white folk were basically saying to him was, Negro, we did not give you license to talk about foreign policy. You do not talk about how we spend federal budget dollars. His argument was, as I said earlier, that war is the enemy of the poor. And so while Johnson is, you know, declaring a war on poverty, you engage in a war in Vietnam, all the resources are being scattered and, you know, quite frankly, wasted, you know, in Vietnam. And Martin wanted to hold him accountable to doing some real work on this war on poverty. As you know, they killed Martin days before he got to Washington. We know he dies in Memphis working with the sanitation strikers. But he's on his way to Washington in a matter of days to kick off his Poor People's Campaign. He and thousands of others were going to camp out in tents, literally, and just live and stay on the National Mall and embarrass Congress to really do something about poverty and put some more teeth into that war on poverty. So he was going to be the original Occupy movement, if you will.
But it never happened.
It never happened. They killed him before he got there because they knew what that imagery would look like of thousands of folk in tents, as Martin and his people called it, Resurrection City. They knew what that would look like. And so it's ironic and interesting after all these years, Marty, to consider that at one point J. Edgar Hoover named Dr. King inside the FBI as the most dangerous man in America. Now think about this. How can you be the most dangerous man in America when you only are using two weapons? The first is ideas. I guess that means Victor Hugo was right. There's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. His weapon was ideas. And secondly, love. You're the most dangerous man in America, and your weapon is love. I think that says something to us even today about the power of love.
Well, it also tells us something about the FBI then, because they were taping his recordings and his conversations.
And had informants inside his own camp. As you know, the treasurer of his organization, James Harrison, his own treasurer, paid FBI informant. His personal photographer, paid FBI informant. Martin had no idea he was being wiretapped and under surveillance everywhere all the time, and certainly had no idea that there were informants inside his own inner circle. They were after him.
But it's, you know, I'm trying to imagine if someone was taping me when I didn't know what I was saying, the kinds of things that might embarrass me. But as you say, even those tapings, nothing really showed us a very different Martin Luther King.
It's a beautiful thing after all these years to study and to research an icon who really does hold up under the scrutiny of history, because so many icons, after they're dead, stuff comes out and be like, well, they weren't exactly who we thought they were. Now, let me be very clear. Martin was a public servant, not a perfect servant, as we've already established in this conversation. This text, Death of a King, does not shy away from his faults, frailties, and shortcomings. Having said that, this love ethic that he talked about was in his DNA. And of all the hours and hours and hours of tapes, Marty, not one time, not a single solitary time, is he ever heard contesting the humanity of another individual, never demonizing, nothing derogatory, nothing derisive or demeaning. Or he just, I mean, that love ethic was who he was in public and in private, and that brought some sublime joy to me.
But there, some would say, because he had affairs, I mean, that sort of discredits him as a civil rights leader. Yes, no?
I think it discredits any of us when we violate our vows, whether they be to our spouses or to our creator, to our employees. To, you know, we all have a truth that we need to try to tell. I just spoke at a high school here in town this morning. And I was saying to the young people, you have to seek the truth, speak the truth, stand on the truth, and stay with the truth. And even though we have shortcomings in our own lives, because we're not human and divine, we're just human, that does not stop us or absolve us of our responsibility to be always in search of the truth. And so Dr. King put it this way: there's some evil in the best of us and some good in the worst of us. He knew he had shortcomings, and as we discussed earlier, he was trying to deal with that even in the last year of his life.
Let me get Reverend Tim Merrill from Camden, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tim. Nice to have you back
on
the show.
Go ahead. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you. Tavis, you said some things that are really resonating with me, especially as I'm working with young people to try to raise the consciousness concerning Africa, where I've been widely supported with what I do domestically. All of a sudden, there's a lot of resistance. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, as Martin speaks out, or Doc, and I love that you use that, as Doc speaks out against the war in Vietnam, what does that say about the state of black consciousness then and the state now? Is it an issue where our consciousness does not find its way past domestic issues to these international issues? And, of course, Malcolm suffered some of the same critique when he went international.
That's right.
So what does that say about our consciousness, especially in among the black middle class?
Powerful question, Reverend Tim.
Powerful question.
So, one, I think it says, as the Reverend suggested, Reverend Tim suggested, Marty, that black people tend to be contained, and I hate to speak in generalizations, but it is the case that most of us, this is true of Americans writ large, but certainly inside of black America, most of us don't have passports. Those of us who have them don't use them, so that we never get a chance to get outside of America and look on America from the outside in, as opposed from the inside out. And I think that changes one's perspective. One gets outside of America and travels and realizes the things you appreciate about the country, the good, but you can also see the bad and the ugly and the things that we need to work on and how we're perceived around the world. So I think Reverend Tim is right that some of this was just that black folk didn't have any way to process foreign policy. They were still concerned about domestic policy, namely civil and human rights and voting rights, and that's, they were myopic in that sense. Now, that's the first answer. Very quickly, though, and I'm glad you raised this, what troubles me now, Marty, in a contemporary moment, is that somehow black folk have arrived at a place in the era of Obama out of deference to a black president who is essentially a war president with a Nobel Peace Prize. We have become silent on the war question. Dr. King is turning over in his grave at the absolute silence. At best, we are silent. At worst, we're supporting the president in these military excursions, and Dr. King would have none of that were he alive right now. But it's just fascinating for me to see black Americans supporting or being silent on the war question, given our history in this country.
Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I do want to pick up on that. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, Tavis Smiley, our guest on Radio Times in this hour of the show. He's written a book with David Ritz called Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. And again, if you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much that we are discussing in this hour of the show. I think, though, that because of the way we have our military now, the sort of 1% that now serves in the military and their family, that many people, not just black people, but many people don't think about our wars because it doesn't really touch us.
Absolutely,
it's not really part of our lives.
Absolutely right, except that for people of color, There ought to be, I think, an even greater, I mean, humanity is humanity, but for people of color, there ought to even be a deeper interest in this, because so much of what we're doing now in this drone program, we're killing innocent women and children of color. So, you know, I get in trouble every time I say this, and yet it is the truth, and, you know, I'm going to say it again, and let me preface it by saying, to those persons who think I'm a hater because I try to hold President Obama accountable, read this book. When you hear what Martin Luther King Jr. said about and to Lyndon Johnson, he always did it in love. He never demonized him. But when you hear how Martin did not ever hold his tongue on Lyndon Johnson fighting this war in Vietnam, I've never said anything near the kind of stuff that Martin said challenging President Johnson in terms of my critique of President Obama. But here's the reality. Barack Obama, as president, is overseeing a drone program on steroids. He's used more drones than George Bush did. He's killed more innocent women and children than George Bush did. And while we say on the one hand we're fighting terrorism, we're creating more terrorists. Because if we kill these innocent women and children, their families are now avowed to strike back at the evil American empire. So while we're fighting an ism, we're creating more ists. And I don't think that's the answer to the prayer.
What do you think it is? I mean, what do you think? How do you, for instance, picking up on the ISIS or ISIL challenge, and, and certainly these are very bad people.
They are.
And they've taken over large parts of both Syria and Iraq.
Which is why the president ought to stop saying we're going to degrade and destroy. You're not destroying anything. You will degrade it, and I hope that we do degrade it. I'm all for that. But you don't destroy an ism, and so you set the American people up thinking that we're going to destroy something. Let's be honest. Evil is a part of the world. There always has been evil, and there always will be evil, and you have to try to contain that. I don't envy the president's position. He's got some difficult choices. Here's my problem, Marty. We always want to start the conversation today as if there aren't consequences that we are suffering today for foreign policy decisions yesterday and the day before that and the day before that. So when people put you on the spot and ask you a question, what would you do now? Mm-hmm. Well, that answer today is not disconnected from what we did yesterday.
There is an argument, though, that perhaps, and I'm not here, I'm not a military person, but an argument that perhaps drones are an effective way to deal with ISIS, because it's not like carpet bombing that we did during Vietnam, for instance.
Right.
I mean, it is more pinpoint than that.
But I have a problem with this notion of, how might I put this, war by joystick, that some kid, some 22, 3-year-old kid is sitting in Nevada with a joystick, literally controlling and dropping drones and killing folk thousands of miles away. So I'm against war. Let me be very clear. I'm not a pacifist like Dr. King was, but I'm against war. Marvin Gaye was right. War is not the answer. But when you come face to face and you got some skin in the game and your guy is as vulnerable as the guy across the way that he's engaging, that changes the equation. A joystick in Nevada and you don't have any consequences and you don't have any repercussions and you don't have to put any, again, I can't think of a better phrase right now, skin in the game, that changes the whole equation for me. So you're right. In some ways, the precision of these drones has been heralded and all of that. But I'm talking about the psychology. I'm talking about the spirituality. I'm talking about all of that that goes into how we make decisions about who we kill and when we kill and where we kill and whether or not we have our consciences burden us if all we're doing is playing some game with a joystick.
You may not agree with me with this, but I have to say, reading your book, which is all about Dr. Martin Luther King, this very difficult year in his life, I did think of Obama because many people have turned against Obama.
That's
He's
right.
been criticized.
That's right.
I don't know what he does behind the scenes, but he kind of takes the high road in public. Do you see any parallels at all?
Not really.
Okay, I thought so.
Yeah, not really. Only because Martin was a prophet and Barack Obama is a politician. He's a very good one. He's a president, but he's not a prophet. I've often wondered, though, Marty, to your point about the parallel, I've often wondered what that bust of Dr. King that sits in the Oval Office, courtesy of President Obama, it wasn't there before he got there. I'm glad it's there. But I often wonder what that bust of King must be whispering to Obama late at night when he's making war plans in the Oval Office. If Martin King were here, he and Obama would be doing a very, very interesting dance on this notion of militarism.
Let me get, looks like Ed from Burlington, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, Ed. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Mr. Smiley, just thank you for all your work. You're fantastic.
Thanks, Ed.
And I just wanted to say, for the record, it would be interesting if folks realized in looking at our school systems across the country to measure that up against the fact that we spent $25 billion, that's with a B, to train the Iraqi army. And what would have happened if even only a small portion of that had been committed to United States.
Yeah.
And where would we be today?
That's why Martin said again, Marty, that war is the enemy of the poor. But then he had a great line that I've used many times. Martin said that budgets are moral documents. Budgets are moral documents. And if I can quote that great philosopher, Jay-Z, you can say what you can say what you say, but you are what you are. And when you put your budget on the table, we see your priorities. And so Martin was right that budgets are moral documents, and that's the point that Ed was making.
And thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Mark from Tioga has to say. Tioga in Philadelphia. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Mr. Smiley, welcome back to Philadelphia,
Thank you.
And I'm listening to this, I'm reminded of the life of another one of my heroes, Paul Robeson.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit, although what happened to Martin in the last year of his life, the vilification that he received was bad, in a way it pales in comparison to what happened to Paul Robeson when he spoke out on a similar issue by saying that black people wouldn't fight against the Soviet Union for America because of America's racist activities. Paul was vilified like Martin on steroids, more or less, pulled before the House Un-American Activities Committee, loss of passport, loss of any bookings in the United States, and of course without the passport he couldn't go to the countries where he was still being well received.
Mm-hmm.
His earnings go from about $100,000 a year to nothing, and it takes a Supreme Court decision for him to finally get his passport back and for people to realize that he had the right to his opinion and to express it.
Well, Mark,
in the country with the First Amendment.
Yeah, Mark, let me just take your point and give Tavis Smiley a chance. I mean, it's interesting parallels.
It is. I take Mark's point well. And Paul Robeson, let me be very clear, is one of my heroes as well. I was just in a conversation the other day, and somebody asked me a good question. And the answer to the question was that I believe Paul Robeson is the ultimate Renaissance man in black America. And I believe that Maya Angelou is the ultimate Renaissance woman in black America. And that's you can, beyond this conversation, those listening, you can kind of play with that yourself. In black America, who would be the ultimate Renaissance man? Paul Robeson did everything. Maya Angelou did everything. I don't know two Americans in our community who are more Renaissance. So I certainly agree with the way that he described what happened to Robeson. But this is what happens to Martin. And at the end, they went after Robeson, but they didn't put a bullet in his head. Martin paid the ultimate price with his life, and so I wouldn't ever compare the two, but I think there's an interesting parallel.
Mark, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. It seemed that Martin Luther King, as you write about him, Tavis, really admired Muhammad Ali, also turned against the war.
Yeah, and for all the obvious reasons. I mean, Ali, this is why I love Ali. I mean, Martin King, I dedicate this book to Dr. King and refer to him as America's greatest democratic, small d, America's greatest democratic public intellectual. That's my dedication to Dr. King in this text. But to my mind, Muhammad Ali, greatest athlete of all the time, of all time. And he of course, he told us that himself.
Yes,
I'm the greatest of all time. Yeah.
That's
so
right.
That's not a Tavis original. Ali told us that. But in this instance,
and we believed him.
Yeah, and I agree with Ali. He is the greatest of all time, but not because of his expertise in the ring, although he was the best. But he took the ultimate risk. I mean, can you imagine any major athlete today at the prime of his or her career taking a principled position on war or any issue, taking a principled position and being castigated and just walking away in their prime? I can't think of a single athlete who would just walk away in their prime.
And that's Tavis Smiley, our guest today on Radio Times, talking about a lot of things, including his new book called Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. We have an explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
A snowball's chance in Iraq.
At least in Iraq, there is a new government which needs to succeed. This is Iraq's last chance to be Iraq.
Former Congresswoman Jane Harman looking for upside in the fight against ISIS. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Rodale Institute supports WHYY and will open its Kutztown Organic Orchard for the whole family to pick organic apples, eat organic food, and take wagon rides to the pumpkin patch. Experts will be on hand to answer questions about growing fruit trees organically. Since 1947, the Rodale Institute has taught that healthy soil equals healthy food equals healthy people. The Organic Apple Festival is open to the public on Saturday, September.
This is a statewide required monthly test of the emergency alert system, originating from the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, Harrisburg. This is only a test.
You lived in with this, some clear violence, that there was something about King's nonviolence as a young boy that you found attractive?
A deacon in my church gave me a gift, and the gift was a box full of recordings, LP recordings of King. Barry Gordy of Motown fame had the good sense to send an engineer to follow King around as he gave speeches. He did give more than one speech in his life called I Have a Dream, and Barry Gordy had allowed that recorded, and he later put out albums of some of these talks that King gave. So this deacon had collected these albums and gave them to me. I do not know why to this day, but he gave them to me as a gift. What I heard when I heard King's voice was love. He was talking to the nation about the power of love. He's talking to the nation about the fact that hate is not an option. And he's talking to the country, but he might as well have been talking to a 12-year-old kid named Tavis, because what I heard him saying to me with this notion of love, Marty, is that, Tavis, you are going to have to love your way out of this situation, that hate is not an option, bitterness is not an option. He spoke to me in such a very real way. He became part of my DNA, and he had long since been dead, but he literally saved my life. Now, my sister, who you referenced, went the other direction. Mm-hmm. She became a crack addict, had a bunch of kids out of wedlock, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Thankfully, things are much better for her in her life at this point. But the only thing that kept me from being an embittered, angry black child was that love that I heard coming through Dr. King's. When I heard the love in his heart, the hope in his soul, it was so reassuring for me. And so since I was 12, I've been a student of King, but since I was 12, I also committed myself then to doing my small part to make the world safe for his legacy. And to my mind, that legacy is simply justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. And that's what I've been trying to do all these years.
I wonder, too, clearly you were a child who was abused, mm-hmm. whether you have a kind of a special feeling for other kids who find themselves in that situation.
I do. And certainly these days, the story of Adrian Peterson in the NFL is everywhere.
So I
know that story intimately well. That is to say, what happens when a parent goes a little too far. And in my case, I'm in the hospital for 2 weeks in traction trying to recuperate from this severe beating. And so Adrian's situation with his child was not nearly that horrific, but you're talking a 4-year-old kid here. And all it just underscores for me is that parents aren't always right, and parents don't always have the answers. And there is the truth, and there's the way to the truth. And we're always on that journey trying to get to the truth of our own life and our own process in life. And so I think Adrian Peterson has learned a lesson here. I know my father learned a lesson. And certainly, as you all know and your callers know, this is part of the black tradition of, you know, whipping and spanking. The part that has not been said, which is fascinating, is where that tradition came from.
Oh,
the master
and slavery,
and that's
and
where
all of that.
That's how black people got turned on to this notion of whipping each other. So there's a whole another conversation about where this even
I mean, if you put it that way, and I get it, is then the victim in a sense becomes the perpetrator.
Absolutely,
right?
That's what I say.
And on it goes.
Exactly, that's a whole other conversation, but it is worth raising so that we can at least contextualize how this starts, and maybe there are some black people who will start to think or view that a little bit differently in terms of how we discipline. But I will tell you this: my father, there was never a day in my life. I hated my father after that beating, but there was never a day in my life, even then, where I didn't believe that my father loved me. He snapped. He lost it. He went too far. He got arrested. He went to court. It was all in the local newspaper. We had to work our way through that as a family. But I never doubted that my dad loved me, but he snapped. And I learned a lesson from that even as a 12-year-old kid. I never, ever say what I will never do because I'm human. And nothing human is alien to me. Nothing good is alien to me. And nothing bad is alien to me. Anything is possible if the conditions and circumstances are right. So I never say what I wouldn't do because I've seen that work against you.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Ken from Parksburg joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Smiley, it's wonderful to hear your voice. I listened to your book last week on Audible and was thrilled that you chose to read the book.
Thank you very much. That was a rough journey for me. I mean,
Not an easy thing to do.
I do radio and television every day, Ken, but that audio book was the toughest thing I have ever done.
I can only imagine. I listen and it's reading and reading and reading, but it was wonderful to listen to.
Thanks.
I turned right away to the drum major instinct, and would you take a few minutes and talk about that speech? It's my favorite. Everybody knows about I Have a Dream, but that speech is just so wonderful, and it mixes scriptures with philosophy and his vision of life. And would you just take a minute and talk about that?
Thanks, Ken.
I think you just did, Ken, and you did it beautifully. the drum major instinct is such a beautiful piece of prose. And everything Martin said, Marty, was like poetic. He spoke in such beautiful phraseology. And so this drum major instinct speech is such a powerful speech. That is the speech from which they took the words that appear on the monument
in
Washington.
Right?
Exactly. That became a controversy.
Yes.
But the point was they knew what they were working with in terms of, you know, we're going to go to this drum major speech to find these words that we're going to etch in this monument because they are so rich. Basically, what Martin is saying is that if he's going to be called a drum major, he wants to be called a drum major for justice. That's his ultimate conclusion, that I want to be a drum major for justice. I want to say that I want folk to say when I die that Martin tried to help somebody, that he tried to love somebody, that he tried to serve somebody. And if they do call me a drum major as a leader, say that I was a drum major for justice. It is a powerful piece of prose. And I agree with Ken. For all the speeches that Martin Luther King Jr. gave, he's regarded most for I Have a Dream. But to my mind, pardon my English, it ain't the best. There were days that Martin did, you know, I think infinitely better in his appearances than he did on that I Have a Dream. And that's a pretty good speech. But he was doing this all the time. And some of his sermons at Ebenezer on Sunday morning are as powerful as I Have a Dream. So you got to get into his corpus. And I will say very quickly, the one thing about this book that I love, and you read it so you know this, is that we put you, as I said earlier, in the space with him. But there's so much of Martin's words in this book. Martin is talking to you and talking to the nation all throughout the book. So if you think he only gave one speech in his life, when you read this book, you'll see all the other stuff that Martin said that you never heard before.
One of the things that you say in this book is that his martyrdom, his death, his assassination, ended up in a weird sort of way sanitizing him, making him the more sort of benign Martin Luther King.
His martyrdom has muffled his message. We get so caught up talking about the assassination and who killed him and whether they operated alone, and we, of course, have made him a hero. As I said earlier, we've deified him in life, even though we demonized him in death. And why do you do that? Because it's easy to celebrate dead martyrs. It's easy to honor dead martyrs. Because we don't have to deal with the truth, the unsettling truth they're trying to tell us. But I just think we focus so much on his martyrdom that we never, ever get to his message. And that's what Martin, I think, would have us deal with, that message of justice for all and service to others and a love that liberates people and that triple threat of racism and poverty and militarism. That's what he'd much rather us deal with than all the martyrdom and the monuments and the postage stamps, etc.
Let me get, looks like Debbie from Willow Grove to join our conversation. Hi, Debbie. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
You know, I want to ask about something you said about President Obama because, you know, he is criticized all over the place for resisting war and for being cautious. And you yourself mentioned the difficult spot he's in. And as Marty mentioned, you know, the drones are, you know, supposed to be an improvement over sending men over there. And, you know, that, I mean, he's, like you say, it's a pretty difficult thing, and he's very, 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 very much trying. It seems that they're just being tireless about, you know, figuring out how to do this ISIS thing. I mean, like you said, you know, when you're face-to-face with evil. And it seems like when people criticize Obama, then, you know, the next 10 minutes when they really analyze the thing, he's really doing the right thing, and he's doing, you know, more than many presidents in, you know, is being pretty pretty thoughtful about how he's approaching this, and I'm not sure he deserves the criticism. So I'm just wondering if you can expand on that.
Sure, yeah. Debbie. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
It's a good question. I answered the question about President Obama in the context of what Martin would say. And again, I repeat, if he were here, he'd be challenging him on this notion of militarism, number one, because we do have a policy that makes us enemies around the globe. Number two, as I tried to intimate earlier, my problem with our foreign policy is that it's schizophrenic. You're our friend today. You're our enemy tomorrow. Look at this excursion right now that we're engaged in. A few months ago, Debbie, to your point, a few months ago, Barack Obama was telling Assad in Syria, don't step across my red line. Assad stepped across the red line. Obama did nothing. And we were told that he was guilty of gassing his own people. Now, Assad is our friend.
Not exactly. Not exactly our friend.
When I say our friend, what I mean is we now have an understanding with Assad and the government of Syria to do what we're about to do right now. But we were told weeks ago he was gassing his own people. So what's happened in the last few months that's allowed us to work with him when a few weeks ago he was gassing his own people? That's what I mean by schizophrenic policy. George Bush a few years ago declared Iraq part of the axis of evil, and now Iran, part of the axis of evil, and now we're on the same side as Iran on this particular question. That's what I mean by a schizophrenic foreign policy. And so my point is that when we start the conversation today as if there were no yesterday decisions, that puts us in a really strange place for analysis. So I'm not criticizing the president, you know, without some rationale behind my critique. I'm just saying that for the U.S. government writ large, for the American people writ large, that we have got to find a better way to coexist in the world.
Debbie, thanks for the call. Let me get Jim from Glenside to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, hello.
Hi there.
Nice to speak to both of you. I admire both your work. I'm a big listener. And I did want to ask you one thing, Mr. Smiley.
Sure.
I am 64 years old. I was very involved with peace. Back in the day, I've always tried to live what you talked about, justice, service, love, and all of them things. And my question is, when you were talking about Dr. King's, the way he was and how he stood up for these things, would you think, with all that has gone on in the last bunch of years, and I know this is a very difficult question to
go ahead,
answer,
Jim. Go ahead, Jim.
How do you think he might have evolved or changed or, from his most idealistic thoughts? Because I know mine don't stay the same, and they're always being challenged. And I guess that's what I had to say.
Fair enough. Thanks for the question.
Let me answer it very quickly in three ways with the three things from the books. I don't need to give you my analysis. Let me just tell Jim what's in the text. Number one, Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream in 63. By the time he gets to 67, the last year of his life, he has said publicly that that dream had become a nightmare. That's one piece of evidence. Secondly, in a dinner with Harry Belafonte at Harry Belafonte's home with Belafonte and a few other people, he's told Harry Belafonte, for all the work that we have done to integrate, I believe that we have integrated into a burning house. That's Martin King. We've integrated into a burning house. Third, last answer. King was killed on that balcony in Memphis on a Thursday night, Jim. Had he made it back to Atlanta that Sunday, he'd already called into his secretary what his sermon topic was going to be that Sunday so they could get it typed up, Marty, in the Sunday morning bulletin. The sermon that he was going to preach, had he made it back to Atlanta to Ebenezer Sunday morning, was entitled, Why America May Go to Hell. He didn't say we were going to hell. His sermon topic was going to be on Sunday morning, Why America May Go to Hell. His thesis was, again, if we don't deal with racism, poverty, and militarism, that triple threat, we are simply going to lose our democracy. America is going to slide into hell. When you tell folks that the I Have a Dream man, Marty, was going to preach a sermon called Why America May Go to Hell, they can't get that full picture. So Jim's point is right. Over the 5 years after, during the 5 years after I Have a Dream, he evolved on a number of different things, including he was starting to question whether or not America had the capacity to live up to its best ideals.
Maybe he would have become a Black Panther.
I doubt that.
You doubt that?
He said repeatedly to Stokely Carmichael that, black power is a beautiful slogan. It's just not a strategy.
And he did, the fires in Newark that summer of 67, that challenged King as
Newark challenged him. Detroit challenged him. He said when asked why he didn't go to Detroit, he said, "I'm not going to go there because I think my going there would be futile. What I need to do, what black leaders need to do, is the heavy lifting to do the real work to make sure that these kinds of riots don't continue to happen in the coming days and weeks and months." And that would be my caution to black leaders today. Running to Ferguson is one thing, but what are we doing vis-a-vis public policy to make sure that the racism and poverty that these people face every day in these communities can be alleviated at some point in this country's future?
Here's a really weird segue.
Yes.
You were on Dancing. You're on Dancing with the Stars. In fact, we posted you doing the Foxtrot on our Facebook page. What possessed you to do that?
I was about to turn 50. As a matter of fact, I just turned 50 last week. And I thought I would do one last really stupid, foolish, ridiculous, embarrassing thing before I turn 50. Just get out of my box. And so I did it, and this is it. And the good news is that we survived week one. I'm safe into week two. As you mentioned, last week was the Foxtrot. This coming Monday night at 8 on ABC, we will do the cha-cha.
Oh.
Doing a little cha-cha-cha. And I'm excited about that. So it's a lot of fun. My dancing partner, Shauna Burgess, is on tour with me. So she's at the hotel sleeping while I'm doing book stuff. But every day, every night, at some point, we find 4 or 5 hours in the schedule for rehearsal, even when I'm traveling. So it should be a great show Monday night.
You were raised Pentecostal, right?
And as a kid,
Were you allowed to dance as a kid?
That's one of the reasons why I made the decision to dance as well. As a child, I was raised in a very, very, very strict, you know, fundamentalist Pentecostal family. I couldn't listen to secular music. I couldn't go to dances. I was the junior and senior class president in high school, and I couldn't go to my prom, junior or senior year. I couldn't listen to secular music, couldn't go to the prom, couldn't watch Soul Train, couldn't watch American Bandstand. We were forbidden for anything having to do with secular music. And so I didn't get a chance to really, and I'm a music lover. I was choir director. I'm a music guy. I played saxophone, played piano. I'm a music guy. But I couldn't discover the full scope of music, classical and soul and rock and all of that, until I got to college. I couldn't go to the movies. Mm. I couldn't play sports. A very strict family. So there's some things that at 50 I wanted to try, and dancing is one of them.
Well, Tavis Smiley, as always, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And the book is called Death of a King, written with David Ritz, and it's subtitled The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. Tavis Smiley is speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter and podcasts, and how to find us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.